Good morning. Welcome to your Sunday morning philosophy show. And happy Father's Day to everyone. You have a father. Hopefully you are a father or will become a father. It is one of the greatest and deepest joys in the known universe, which is kind of exactly what you would expect, of course, since it is a huge time and money investment. You'd expect nature to make it a great deal of fun. And it is a great deal of fun, especially if you have a witty and sarcastic child, as I do. It's very funny. She came down earlier than usual this morning, and I, of course, pretended that she was a hologram and remarked just how vivid it actually was, how realistic it actually was, how it really felt like she was actually right there in the room being projected from her sleeping form upstairs at some point, at which point she offered very kindly to pour honey on my forehead, claiming that if honey was on my forehead, it might actually make it less oily. It's very funny. So I hope you had a good dad. If you didn't have a good dad, I'm sorry about that. If your mother didn't choose a good father for her children, I'm sorry about that too. But the great thing about having bad parents, it's a great instruction manual on how to be a good parent. All you have to do is the polar opposite. And if you do the polar opposite, man, you are all set. So even the negative instruction can be a very positive instruction. And the one thing that I would say, and I'm happy to take calls this morning, but the one thing that I would say about parenthood is that the massive compatibility between men and women, I think, is best expressed in the different things they take seriously and the different things they take less seriously. So men have evolved to finish raising children. Women have evolved to start raising children. Women are almost personality opaque when babies are very little. And what I mean by that is you don't have much of a sense of self when you're taking care of a baby because the baby's needs are so omnipresent, the baby can't negotiate. So you have to, and I say this having myself taken care of a baby, you almost have to cease to exist. And so the fact that a lot of women don't seem to have, you know, very strong, knowledgeable, particular perspectives and so on. A lot of women, not all, of course, right? And there's a lot of men that way too, but a few more women. You have to kind of cease to exist in a way when you're dealing with babies because you can't really negotiate. You can't really express a preference. You just have to conform like water being poured into a jar or a bowl. You just have to conform to what the baby needs. It's a pretty wild experience to not exist as an ego. You have to be without ego in order to take care of babies and toddlers. And it's a pretty wild experience. And again, remember that women evolved to take care of babies and toddlers for most of their lives, right? You'd get married in your mid-late teens, evolutionarily speaking, or you'd pair bond up. You'd start having babies pretty much right away. And then you would have as many babies really as your system could handle for the most part. A lot of them would die, and you'd still have to take care of the others. I mean, people sometimes get concerned, and I remember seeing this a couple of times where women can just turn their feelings off. You know, like if they're upset with some guy or whatever, they go from sort of very passionate to just cold, right? Just don't care about you at all. I mean, I remember having a very passionate relationship with a woman at a high school, and we were together, I think, about 2 years. And then for some reason, I had to call her a year after we broke up. And it was really like absolutely talking to a stranger. Now, I'm not saying that she should have kept her flame or anything like that. I get all of that. But when women move on, they move on. And part of the reason for that, of course, is that women can't overly grieve in many ways because nature was so brutal with their offspring, right? Your child is dying in your arms. Your next one survives. The next one dies in your arms. There's nothing you can do. And you just got to soldier on. And there's really not much time to grieve. And then, you know, there's a war, your man dies, or there's an industrial accident, or some sort of hunting accident, or farm accident. Ah, it's brutal, brutal in history. So women have to be able to turn their feelings off because they have to be able to move on and have the kid survive. And then the kid dies and you've got to move on. And so you just kind of have, so there's a pair bonding for sure, but the continuity of emotion is a little bit different for women. And so women would, you know, in their 20s, they'd be having babies. In their 30s, it would start to fade out a little bit, depending on whether they had sort of early onset menopause or something like that. And then, of course, by the time they're in their 40s and their eggs are pretty much gone, well, the kids they had in their early 20s are now having kids themselves, and they're a grandmother, and so they're helping with the next generation of toddlers and so on. And they are really designed to deal with creatures you cannot really negotiate with. And because there was no particular rational proof of ethics, of course, until universally preferable behavior, almost 20 years ago that I wrote, women had to be, in a sense, slaves to their babies, because you just got to do what the baby needs. And then they had to be kind of bullies to their toddlers, because you got to teach the toddlers the social customs, the religious customs, the right and wrong, the habits, the politeness. I remember when my mother was not religious, but when I would go and visit my aunts on my father's side in Ireland, very religious, very religious. One of my earliest memories is trying to sneak a 5-penny piece that I was supposed to put in the collection plate into my sock so that I could spend it later at the candy store and hopefully buy a Curly Whirly, which is a pretty sweet toffee treat in the UK, I guess. And as they show me, they very, very, very brusque, not punitive. I was never punished by them. All right, show me your coins. And I'm like, oh, I kept mine in my sock for for safekeeping. I was really a terrible liar as a kid. And they're like, well, it's supposed to go in the collection plate. But they were very strict about politeness and rules and table manners and all of that. And so, I mean, there's no particular explanation. It's just nice. It's what's expected. It's the right thing. It's the proper thing. They're just rules that you have to copy paste into your children's brains with no particular rationale or justification. Elbows off the table. Well, why? And of course, elbows off the table made kind of sense in the past when everybody was really crowded around a table. But when you've got room, it's crass, it's coarse. All of these things are just synonyms for people will think you're in the lower class. That's all. do not be mistaken for somebody who was raised in the lower class, because in the UK, that's like a huge deal. And so they turn from, in a sense, slaves to babies to kind of bullies of toddlers, which is why a woman can totally fall for you and be your, quote, servant, or, you know, really conform to what it is that you want, and then a switch can flip, and then she suddenly becomes aggressive or a bully or something. And again, this is not all women, but it's certainly some women, and again, some men, just a little bit more women than men, just to sort of be clear. There's this line, what was it? The Tropic of Cancer writer, Norman someone or other, he said, you never really know your wife until you meet her in court. Norman Mailer, yeah, did he stab his wife, I think, with a knife? And he said, well, if it's only a knife, there's some love left. And the switch that flips in some women from being devoted to being tyrannical is because women have to be egolessly devoted to babies, and then they have to be very tyrannical to toddlers. That's how culture gets replicated and how rules get enforced. And then, of course, as children sort of sail into there's a latency period from the end of toddlerhood until a year or two before puberty, where the personality is pretty calm and things are pretty stable and so on. And usually that's the time when the children are supposed to transfer from the females to the males. I mean, it's an old Jewish law that if there's a divorce, the women get the children until the age of 7, and then they move to the fathers. They move to the fathers. And women worry excessively about two things. Now, excessively is the male perspective from later. It's all evolution, so it's all perfect in the way that it's evolved. But women worry more about two things. They worry more about physical injuries, and they worry more about social acceptance. And one of the reasons they worry more about physical injuries is that boys are giant, blur-legged death magnets. They climb everything. They jump on everything. They'll jump straight into a pond. They will jump off a wall without checking. They're just absolute blur-legged death magnets. And so you have to worry about physical injuries for boys because they have the common sense of a goose's ass when it comes to physical safety. I remember those phases myself, just no particular sense of physical danger, physical safety. So women worry more about physical dangers for their boys, and they worry more about social acceptance for their girls. And, you know, one of the problems with sort of the scold, woke, turbo Karen society that we live in now is that the physical danger has been banned and social acceptance has been brutally enforced. These things are fine when it's just in the family, right? But they're not fine when they're turned over to the government, to the state, because then it becomes tyranny. And this is all perfectly appropriate. It's all perfectly appropriate to little boys and little girls. It's just that when you ally these instincts with the power of the state, then you end up with a tyranny. I was watching a video last night with my daughter of, it was a joke video. Some guy was saying to a lifeguard, "Hey, Ryan, would you rather watch people swim all day or jump out of the blazing hot sun into the pool?" And then the voiceover was, "Well, you know, it's really important to keep people safe who come to use this pool, and that's my job," and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, the guy jumped off his lifeguard chair, ran around the pool, and got on a giant diving board and took a big flip into the water. And I was saying to my daughter, I said, you know, when was the last time we went to a pool with a diving board? They almost completely vanished. You go look at these playgrounds from like the 1920s. These massive structures, giant slides, all on bone-shattering concrete. They probably threw around bits of glass to challenge the children's feet, try and turn them into hobbits or something. Danger has been stripped away. We used to go to this petting zoo from time to time. That was really cool. I mean, you could pick up the baby goats. I wrote about this actually in my novel, The Future. You should really check it out. It's a great book, freedomain.com/books. And we used to be able to lift these goats up, carry the goats, baby goats. I remember we would lift the goats up so that they could nibble on the leaves of the trees. It was huge fun, huge fun. And then, boom, one day we go, what's happened? Well, you're not even allowed to touch the animals anymore. I mean, deflated, right? We barely went back. And I asked, because I'm always curious. I'm like, well, what? We used to be able to pick up the goat. Oh, one of the hooves of the goat scratched a kid's leg, and the mother threatened to sue. And so now the kids can't touch. You can feed them, but you can't really touch them. You're not even allowed to pet them. And of course, this hyper lawsuit planet that people live in, I think it's particularly true in the States. It's just, well, my child is hurt. And women feel, you know, I mean, the child came from their flesh. Like, they feel it as more than the child feels it. I get all of that. But this bubble-wrapped childhood of hyper-protection does not protect people. You have to be able to push the envelope physically so that you can learn how to manage risk. Because if you can't learn how to manage risk, you really can't have much of a life. It's risky to go ask for a raise. It's risky to leave a job and try and get a new job. It's risky to go and ask the girl that you want out. It's risky to drive a car. It's everything is risk. And the one thing that's really true of contemporary, matriarchal, significantly fatherless Western society is we've completely lost the ability to process and manage risk. It's gone, man. People view terrible risks as completely safe, and they view relatively safe activities as completely dangerous. I mean, I think it's a good thing that people wear bike helmets. I think it's a good thing that kids wear bike helmets. I remember a friend of mine's girlfriend, when she learned that I used to bike to work an hour and a quarter to get to work, and like on the roads, obviously. And she's like, "Do you wear a helmet?" And I'm like, "No, I hadn't even really thought. I'd never really thought of it." And I wore headphones, so I couldn't hear anything. And I did this for a long time. And she worked a volunteer line, like a call center line for emergencies. And she said the number of people like who end up with horrible brain damage from biking and falling and not wearing a helmet. So she did convince me to wear a helmet, and I did end up wearing a helmet. So I think those things are good. I don't know, man, though, the knee pads, elbow pads, helmet, wrist guards, and so on for things like roller skating, or I guess rollerblading is a thing now, or skateboarding and so on. I remember when I was a kid, when I lived in England, there was this big curved pathway that went from the relatively nicer flats or apartment buildings down to the real grungy bungalows, the guy sitting out front with empty cans of lager and wife beater t-shirts on and chest hair and guts and spindly legs. It's the British physiognomy, like a little bit of chest hair, giant gut and spindly legs. And my friends and I used to take our skateboards and we would grab a handful of sticks and we would go down the skateboards, and the goal was to drop a stick and win the race. If you drop a stick at the right angle, at the right size of stick, the skateboard would just stop. Like it would hit the stick and hit the stick and just break. And this is all while navigating a fairly fast curve. And there were two railings and then a big drop from there down to a sort of grassy area. A drop like at least 8 to 10 feet. I mean, I know that you remember these things differently because you're young and all of that, but I'm pretty sure it was pretty high because I remember hanging from it and it was still a long way down. So 8 to 10 feet. It was one of the courage tests, was to hang and drop. That's how you knew you were a big kid now. So we would go down these curved concrete areas, as curved concrete. It was a walkway. And we would be focusing on trying to drop the sticks and get the other kid to have a skateboard. And he'd go tumbling off the skateboard if you're going fairly fast. And then if it slows down really quickly, you'd go tumbling off the skateboard. And, you know, you'd have your strawberry knees and elbows and so on. But it was considered a mark of manhood to not complain too much about these things. And it was a great deal of fun. Because here's the thing. What is life if you don't have any stakes? What is life if you don't have any stakes? I mean, why? Why? I mean, who bothers really playing a video game in God mode? Or attractive young female mode? People say God mode, it should be goddess mode. I mean, you need the stakes, right? And it was hysterically fun. Great memories. And I do remember one time, and you know, this taught me something. One time I was focusing too hard on getting my friend's skateboard to drop in the stick to get my friend's skateboard to stop so that I would win the race. And I was looking back too far. And what happened? Well, I was sitting on my skateboard with my knees up. I was that young, I guess, sitting on my skateboard with my knees up, and I was about to go over the edge to go 10 feet down. Now, onto grass, so it would have been bad, but not terrible. And, shins, man. Oh, burking the shins, they call it. It's really the worst thing, because shins, I don't know about yours, my shins are kind of sharp on the front. And because I had my knees up, I went into the lower metal bar, full tilt, and clanged my shins to the point where my vision went blurry. It was really bad. Like I could barely walk. And I still think about that occasionally. You know, every now and then when you're driving, you want to switch lanes or something and you're checking your blind spot and there's some D-bag who's in your blind spot and you're checking it and then you remember, oh my God, I gotta make sure I check ahead of me too, just in case traffic is stopped or something like that, or somebody coming into my lane or whatever. And so I think about that from time to time, that, you know, don't check behind too much. Don't try and win too much that you clang your knees on a metal bar to the point where you're worried you're going to end up with permanent dog-shaped legs for the rest of your life. It's a good lesson. It's a good lesson. Probably saved my life at one time or another, having that base body memory. And I think I've been pretty good at navigating risk over the course of my life. I mean, telling the truth to a volatile NPC world is quite the extreme sport, to put it mildly. And I think I've done, I do review this every now and then, like in my mind. How have I done? Have I told enough truth to be valuable? But not so much truth that you get strung up by your Buster Browns, as the mayor says in Jaws. I think I've navigated pretty well. I've taken a good chunk of risks in my life. I did, when I had my first programming job, I worked there for less than a year. And I used to take these very long lunches to try and get my side business started, take these meetings and so on, which is a bit risky. And I ended up quitting my first regular paycheck at a professional job to start a business. It worked out pretty well. I had a wild time in that entrepreneurial world. And then I took time off from that to write books, which was a risk. And of course, you know, some of my risks don't pay off, right? I spent a year and a half researching books. I read The God of Atheists, and I took a Canada's Best Writing class and wrote my novel Almost, which is like a 300,000 plus word. It's basically three books, and it's amazing, amazing books, fantastic books, if I do say so myself. Again, freedomain.com/books. And that did not pay off. I got the most amazing reviews from professional editors and professional readers. One even called it The God of Atheists. Finally, we have the great Canadian novel. This is the most amazing moral story I've ever read, and blah, blah, blah. Like, just, and I thought, of course, I didn't realize, since my books generally are criticize collectivism, leftism, and postmodernism. The God of Atheists has a character who is scathingly funny about postmodernism. And of course, I wouldn't get published for those reasons, because I still thought there was something about a meritocracy in publishing. So my naivete. So some of my gambles, the gamble of throwing a fair amount of money to support myself and taking a year and a half of my life to try and get published, those gambles did not pay off. I mean, they paid off in that I have these great books, but it did not pay off in terms of having any kind of career or anything like that. So those gambles didn't pay off. Some of the gambles I took in my show, talking about IQ, talking about crime, talking about feminism, talking about the voluntary family, peaceful parenting, and all of that. I mean, some of those were, you know, pretty close to the cliff edge. Pretty close to the cliff edge. I felt like a stuntman. A drunken stuntman. But, you know, I think sort of in hindsight, I got really essential truths out. And, you know, so I had some less than ideally comfortable bits of time in my life, but began probably close to 2 billion assaults prevented against children. And I can't even tell you how many boys weren't circumcised because of the work that I did. And, yeah, I mean, that's just cost benefit overall plus. And, you know, I also have the pride and self-satisfaction of having done these good things, which took some courage. Perhaps I tend a bit more towards foolhardiness, but I did the right things in high risk. And I think one of the reasons why I did the right things at high risk is that I learned how to manage risk as a little kid. And because of that, I think I was better at trying to manage trying to manage risks as an adult. Now, of course, moms are concerned that their children are going to be rejected by their peers, right? You know, the sort of terrible stories that moms have of my boy is just a little strange, or just a little different, or just a little odd, and he never gets invited to any birthday parties, or, you know, these absolutely heartbreaking stories of the kids who throw birthday parties and they rent the clowns and the face paints and put up the balloons and the ribbons and nobody comes. Like just heartbreaking stuff for sure. And that's painful to people, of course. Of course, it's painful to people. I mean, it would have to be. Yeah, and these are very sad situations with kids who don't get invited to the birthday parties or don't nobody comes to their birthday parties. It's funny, you know, I was always sort of in the middle of popularity. I was never the most popular kid, but I certainly was never, I was never rejected or isolated. Like I always had friends, always had people to hang with, always had people. And people always came to my parties and I would go to people's parties and all of that. I was never like the in-demand must-have kid, the center of social attention. But I certainly was never rejected or isolated in that kind of way. Because, I mean, one of the things that was sort of important for me was to make sure that the people I was spending time with had a good time. Like, it's sort of a basic, it was kind of an instinct, I think, which is sort of a basic thing, which is just make sure that the people who you're spending time with are enjoying their time with you. It's sort of a basic social transaction thing. And I think that a lot of the people who are kind of rejected are the people who don't really think about, like, they have this expectation or this entitlement, which is, well, I mean, people just want to spend time with me. Like, I deserve an invitation to a party. And, well, you don't. You don't. You don't deserve an invitation to a party, and you don't deserve that anyone comes to your party. It's a simple transaction. The first free market for experience is friendship. It's really, really important to, you know, grind into your bone marrow. The first free market we ever experience is friendship. Yeah, family have to spend time with you, and people in school kind of got to be around you because everybody has to go to school for the most part and all of that. The teacher's got to be there. You go to church. Everybody's got to be there. They're not really making choices. But when it comes to spontaneous, unplanned, unorganized, you know, if you go to karate, right, to take the cue from the fine lady from Wednesday. I think it was Wednesday or Friday we talked about this. If you go to karate, your kid's in karate, then there's going to be like kids around. And the kids are going to spar with you or whatever it is, right? Go to hockey, you're going to have a hockey team. Kids are going to be around. But it's in the spontaneous, unplanned activities that the first free market is experienced by most people. The kids just getting together at someone's house. You don't have to be there. It's not organized. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why people have defaulted to this crazy expensive, endlessly expensive children's activities. I was a friend, a business partner I had many years ago, was like, you know, when I was a kid, we just went out to play. Now, every time your kids go anywhere, it's $50, $100. You know, Chuck E. Cheese, go to the movies, mall. I want to go laser tag. Everything is crazy expensive. Well, I think we all know the reason for that. Huh. Maybe some of the dysfunctional poor people are kept away from the more expensive places and your kids are safer. I don't know. Could be, right? Probably. So that's where people experience the free market is in friendships. Are you invited? Now, if you're not invited, someplace as a kid, I mean, what's your dad going to say? Your mom's heart is going to be broken and she's going to get angry and she's going to take it personally. And this is all evolved, right? This is all evolved. Because if your kid is rejected by the peer group, well, they're not really going to reproduce. So you get kind of upset if you invest all this time, effort, and energy into your kids and then they get rejected by their peer group, which means they're going to be much less likely to succeed, to reproduce, to become part of the hunting tribe, or to have family support, get married, get wooed, all that kind of stuff. So there's grave danger. Now, what do women do when their kids are rejected? Well, they get mad at the other parents. How come my kid wasn't invited to your birthday party? Huh? How come? All the other kids were invited. And this is why you end up with these stupid rules in schools and other places that if you're going to invite a kid, you've got to invite every kid. Subsidies, right? The moms will get mad. Moms will get mad. And they will demand that their kid be included. I don't think that's really the dad's approach. The dad's approach is not to force others to include the kid, but to figure out how to make the kid more appealing to be included. So you got some kid who doesn't get picked for the baseball team, and the mom will get mad. Even if it's just some local baseball team, some pickup, like we used to play pickup. Soccer, we used to play pickup. Baseball. Saturdays for baseball, Sundays for soccer. We used to play. And if there's some pickup game and your kid isn't picked for baseball, the moms will get mad that the kid is excluded and will want to force inclusion for their kid. I mean, honestly, this is just the root of the DEI stuff. It's not even political. Fundamentally, it's maternal. So-and-so is sad, excluded, marginalized, underrepresented. That's unfair, that's wrong, and therefore we have to force inclusion. Now, what do dads do? I mean, we all know, if we've had decent dads, we all know that if, let's say you got a dad and his son Bobby is not picked or isn't chosen or isn't asked to come and play baseball, what does the dad do? Well, the dad says, well, dang, son, I guess we got to get you to be better at baseball, right? Let's go throw and catch. Let's go practice hitting the ball. Let's go do all of that. And that's just a different approach. If you're not included, the moms get mad. If you're not included, the dads work on your skills. Because women are about equality of outcome. Men are about meritocracy. Equality of outcome is perfect for little kids. Meritocracy is essential for the survival of the society. In Father's Day, we see this, of course, all the time. Oh, it's gut-wrenching. It's wretched. Horrifying. It's one of the most repulsive things about modern Western society. And there's a lot to be repulsed about, and there's a lot to praise. A lot to praise. Still wouldn't want to live anywhere else at any other time. But there's some pretty repulsive stuff, too. One of the most repulsive things about modern Western society is the people who win are the whiners, the complainers, the naggers, the tantrum throwers, all of the people who act with what would be to me a despicable lack of pride and self-respect tend to win. Blah! It's gross. It's gross. Success in the modern West has so often something to do with just a blank-eyed humiliation ritual. Well, if you're going to complain enough, we'll give you stuff. If you complain and if you play helpless and spineless and we can't get ahead and we can't do this and that and the other, oh, then we'll give you stuff. We'll give you preferential treatment. If you bow, scrape, and humiliate yourself and pretend that you're helpless, well, then we'll bend the law to give you stuff. Ugh. Which means that men and women with any actual pride end up being fleeced, and the people who are eager, happy, thrilled, and excited to pretend to be helpless and marginalized, well, they get all the goodies. And that's not how men, in general, operate. In general, you don't give your one spear to the whiniest guy. You can't, because you got to come home with some meat, because otherwise your family's going to starve. You got one spear, or even if you've got a bunch of spears, you don't give the first throw, right? Because you got to have the mighty warrior throw the spear at the creature you're hunting, because if you throw and miss, they run, and then you've got to go find them, and then they're alarmed, and it's really hard to. So you, that first guy better be like dead-eyed dick. You better arm like a piston, eyes like lasers. Spear like a fork of lightning straight through the deer's chest. Man, you gotta give the first strike to the best hunter. Not the guy who whines the most, not the guy who complains that, oh man, nobody ever gives me the spear. Come on, man. Guys, let me tip it. Give me a try. Right? And he goes home to mom and says, you know, the guys won't even let me throw the spear, man. I said, oh, come on. I mean, all I want to do is throw the spear, man. Those guys, they get painted on the cave wall. They get all the chicks, man. They're the rock stars. I mean, they never let me throw the spear, man. I shouldn't do that for too long. I feel it's going to change my personality or something. We've all heard this endless tinnitus mosquito whine of complaints that come from people. And of course, you know, the women are like, how come you don't let Squinty Bob over there? Come on, give him a chance with the spear. And we're like, the guys are like, well, we did give Squinty Bob there a chance with the spear. I mean, look, you can see over there. Do you see all those marks on that tree? Do you know how many? Because that's where we practice throwing the spear. I throw a spear at the tree. Now, do you know how many of those marks were made by Squinty Bob when we were practicing spear throwing? Zero. Zero. In fact, we've learned not to make any comments to Squinty Bob when he's about to throw a spear, because I literally turn around and the motion is still going and we got to duck, otherwise we're going to get a spear through the eyeball. So we can't give Squinty Bob the spear. He can't hit anything. It's not personal. You like the meat? You like having calories for the kids? Well, we can't give Squinty Bob the spear because then we don't get any meat. And the fact that he wants to throw the spear, I get it. But we can't afford it, right? Men have to operate on raw meritocracy. Otherwise, the tribe dies. Women have to operate on equality of outcome or the children die, because the younger, smaller children will be outmuscled by the larger, stronger children who will get all the food. The younger, smaller children will be malnourished, more susceptible to illness, infection, disease. So, yep, women have to force equality of outcome. Absolutely. You have to take from the strong and give to the weak. Love them for that. Hey, as a younger sibling, I hugely appreciate the redistribution of income by force that happens from women. I'm not sure my brother would have been laying me out a feast and a spread. He was a little bit focused on his own interests, which, you know, whatever. Elder sibling thing, it's fine. But no, I'm alive. My ancestors were alive. You're alive. We're all alive because women forcibly redistribute resources from the stronger to the weaker and will nag and complain if that's not achieved, and they should. It's not like as a two-year-old, I could advocate for myself. Stop hogging all the food. Give your brother some food. Take it away if you have to. Use force if you have to. That all makes sense. It's all healthy. Again, none of this stuff is unhealthy. Sex is healthy unless it's adult forced. Charity is healthy. Theft is not. Things are healthy until political power takes over, right? So charity is very healthy and necessary. There are people who fall upon misfortune and need help. But political coercive redistribution is neither moral nor healthy. I mean, the welfare state was in many ways introduced so that people would get so dependent upon the system that it would prove immune to change, say, through collapse by people who would rather it collapse so they can institute more, well, communism, let's be frank, is what they're kind of after. A stable functional system can't be changed for the worst, but you destabilize the system. Anyway, this is totalitarianism 101, destabilize, take over. So the woman's instinct when a child is excluded is to force inclusion. The man's instinct, the father's instinct, when someone is excluded, is to up their skill so that they provide value. And therefore, the inclusion will happen on its own. You don't force the inclusion. You raise the skill. And, you know, if you got some kid, it's like, man, my friends keep having these Fortnite games. I never get invited. I don't know. Show me what you got, kid. I'll learn a little bit about Fortnite. Show me what you got. And if every time the kid loses at Fortnite, he throws a tantrum, well, people don't want to play. Of course they don't. Of course they don't want to play. Well, would you? No. I mean, people should be into winning. I get that. But learning how to be a gracious loser, which is something I still occasionally fumble, but learning how to be a gracious loser is kind of important. Because if you don't learn how to be a gracious loser, people find it kind of stressful and unpleasant to play with you. I mean, if you've ever played racket sports, and I've been sort of in leagues and so on, you'll come across these guys who, like, you know, they miss the serve and like, come on, you know, they're really mad at themselves. Come on, and red-faced. I played once with a guy, threw his racket. Threw his racket. I don't want to play with that. Because it's not fun. Hey, I like to win. I like a good competition. But you got to shake hands afterwards. There's an intensity, but a good nature and a good humor about it. You don't want to play chess with a guy who'll punch you in the nose if you take his queen. That's high stakes, but not psycho stakes, kind of the important thing. Juno, I'll get you in a sec. Hang tight. Thank you for your patience. So men and women take different things seriously. I mean, women take doctor's appointments seriously, and they should. Dentist appointments, optometrist appointments, all of that. They take washing hands, like you're keeping a tidy house, clean. All of that stuff they take more seriously than men as a whole, and they should. And that's healthy and helpful. My wife takes natural food very seriously. And I'm glad she does. It helped contribute to my fairly robust health, and I appreciate it. I mean, me, food is mostly just fuel. Like, I'd eat a still frozen pizza in the box if it was more convenient for me. But the fact that she cooks all natural, it's beautiful. I think it's great that she takes that stuff seriously. I wouldn't, but I appreciate it. I take sort of the future of the world perhaps a little bit more seriously than she does. And that's good, too. She helps me lighten up about some things. I help her lighten up about some things. I mean, dads know this one very well. That moms are terrified of children injuring themselves, and dads are like, it'd be fine. It'd be fine. It's kind of how they learn. Even you want to give them caution, but the kids also have to test their own boundaries. And this is one of the things that I really dislike about the modern world, is that politics has been this giant credit card cocaine dividing line between men and women. Not the best analogy, but, you know, you can't always sink one with no net. But politics has become between men and women. Women cleave to the most powerful. I mean, evolutionarily speaking, they had to, because you get regularly taken over and you have to cleave to the most powerful. Women will bully the most powerful to get resources if they have to. You know, if the husband is taking most of the food when he doesn't even really need it and there's not enough for the kids, the woman, she can't physically take it, but she has to sort of nag and withhold sex and manipulate to make sure her children get enough, if she happens to be, as a lot of women were, mated to a selfish man. She's like, hey, fat pig, put down that food. Stop eating. Kids are hungry. You don't need it. You don't need it. And she withholds affection, sex, cold, because she's got to get the food to her kids, and she can't physically overpower the man. So she becomes manipulative and indirect. I had a friend many years ago who somehow got on the Victoria's Secrets mailing list. No, actually he showed me one. It was Chahandla Behing or something like that. He was renting a place. It was still being mailed to the person who was there previously. But he just, you know, back in the day, you couldn't just click unsubscribed. You had to sign a whole letter and never got around to it. So he was going through a tough time with his girlfriend. And she used to go to the mail and make sure that the Victoria's Secrets catalog was not there, because she was concerned that he would flip through it, get turned on, and want to have sex, and they weren't getting along at that time. So she didn't want that stress and difficulty, so she would remove anything that might be sexy in his environment. Of course, she's dressing in the full-on granny flannels and all that kind of stuff. As if that matters to men. As if that matters to men. But anyway, hey, that's really nice lipstick. Don't kiss me, it'll smudge. It's like, well, what's the point? It makes your lips attractive. I can't kiss them. What's the point? But that was I just thought that. I mean, things that would never cross my mind. Things that would never cross my mind. I would, like, if I was dating some woman and she wanted an expensive handbag, I would never imagine going to the mailbox and removing catalogs with expensive handbags to not stimulate her materialism. Like, it would never even cross my mind, but, you know, that's male brain, female brain. Female brain is manipulate the environment to get what you want. Male brain is get what you want, for the most part, right? And again, none of this is negative to males or females. None of this is negative to males and females. We are a delightful combination and the most effective and successful combination in all of life, in all of the universe that we know of. So it's all great. But you combine it with political power, then women will cleave to the most powerful. And you see, men will give women resources in return for children, but the government gives women resources in return for votes. And votes do not encourage the continuation of your civilization. I'll say this again. On Father's Day, just understand how the world is and how it works. Men will give resources to women in return for children. That's why we're so good at getting resources, why we have this crazy half-autistic focus and endurance for work and testosterone and size, strength, power, concentration. We are great at creating resources. We give resources to women in return for children. Now, of course, giving resources to women in return for sex is, I mean, even monkeys do that. You introduce a currency to monkeys, the first thing the men start doing is trading those resources for sex. But of course, in the past, sex meant children. So men giving women resources in return for sex meant children. Men give resources to women in return for sex. Governments give resources to women in return for votes. Votes ate children. All right. Oh, man. I was just winding down. Premature elaboration. Sorry, man. I clean myself up now. People keep dipping in to ask, and then maybe they think I'm going to go on a long speech. They keep dipping in to talk, and then they despawn. They vanish. They ghost me. They dematerialize. All right, so if you have a question or a comment, criticism, thoughts on this lovely Father's Day, I am thrilled to hear from you. I know people have been coming and going. Up and down like the Assyrian Empire. Going once, going twice. And go read my book, The Present, or listen to it on audiobook. It's really, really good. One of my favorites, though, is Dissolution. It's a really good, really good book. And the audiobook reading on that one is the best I think I've ever done. freedomain.com/books. Well, people are coming, people are going, and mostly they're going. That's all totally fine. I'm just going to assume in my pompous manner that the speeches were so great that people did not wish to interrupt. So have yourselves a beautiful day, everybody. Thank you for dropping by today. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Listen, man, I know it's rough out there. I really do. I really do. But if you could spare a bit of support for your friendly neighborhood philosopher, I would really, really appreciate it. freedomain.com/donate. And if you subscribe, you get like tons of goodies. Like, no kidding. History of Philosophers, 23-part series, 12-part series on the French Revolution, and great stuff. Great stuff. So I hope that you will be able to help and support the show. And lots of love, my friends. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.